everybody. Welcome to the Canine Connection podcast. Today, we have our first guest. Lori and I thought it would be kind of fun to have a student on. So I volunteered my student, Donald Bruckner. Unfortunately, Lori cannot be here today. She had an emergency. I was going to postpone, but I think it's just going to make it a little easier for her if we forge on without her. So this is my student, Donald Bruckner, and I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about himself and about his dogs and how he got into this crazy sport of dog training. Go ahead, Donald.
Thank you, Petra. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me. The first dog, well, my wife and I had pet dogs. We had retired racing greyhounds for a number of years. Fast forward to about 1.5 dog lifetimes ago, I always wanted a lab to train, I thought. I had no idea what that meant. So one day, my wife found at the college campus where she was teaching a stray dog that was mostly lab-like. And she brought the dog home and she said, "Can we keep her? Can we keep her?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I was teaching as a college professor at the time. I hadn't gotten tenure yet. I wasn't past, you know, like the provisional period. I'm like, "I don't know." She's like, "Oh, please, oh, please." Long story short, we kept the dog. And she said, I said, "Well, you know, one condition is we've got to train this dog. I want to have a well-trained dog." She's like, "Oh yeah, that's great, because on the way home, I met this woman at the Tractor Supply who was a dog trainer, and she can come over here and she can teach us dog training." And I'm like, "Oh boy, okay, so we're going to have this random woman come over from the Tractor Supply and be our dog trainer. I'll bet I'm going to learn a lot." And I just explained in a nutshell why the sport of competition obedience is dominated by 97% females, because I think that men have that attitude that I had. She came over. We had a really nice lesson. We joined her class in person, and we learned pet dog stuff, basic pet dog stuff. Sit, stay, come, don't jump on people, basic manners. That was the name of the class, actually, basic manners, if I recall correctly. I kept taking classes, the second level of basic manners, the graduate level of basic manners, and I just wanted to do more and more. So she said, the trainer, she's like, "You know, you're doing pretty well with this stuff. You could get a CGC certificate, and you could get even a therapy dog certificate, certification. So we went on, we got our Canine Good Citizenship certificate the same night that we got our Therapy Dogs International certification. And Rufus was a therapy dog. And at some point, again, the trainer said, "You know, you're doing well with this stuff. Maybe you'd like to look at competition obedience." Now, the trainer had a background in competition obedience, but she didn't teach it at school. But she referred me to someone else. I joined the class. And the first class that I observed, they were doing crazy things. They were doing go-outs, which is a utility exercise. You've got to send the dog between two jumps to the opposite side of the ring 50 feet away and tell the dog on the judge's command which jump to go to. And the dogs were doing this. I'm like, "Holy cow." And the other thing that just absolutely blew my mind is the scent article exercise, where there's a bunch of articles out in a pile 20 feet away, and you put your scent through your hand on another article, and the judge takes it out, and you turn around, because the dog isn't looking when the scented article is put out. You turn around, you send the dog, and the dog finds your scent and brings it back to you. So it was stunning to me. So we started to train for competition obedience stuff, and it was a long, mediocre career. And what made it mediocre for us now in retrospect is I could see we started with pet dog training, and I can remember the moment when we were basically learning how to heel, you know, a loose lead walking with a dog. And we, you know, Rufus was 2 feet behind, 2 feet to the left, 2 feet ahead. And we asked, is it okay if the dog is just there? And she's like, unless you're going to show the dog, yes, that's fine. And we rolled our eyes. Well, we're not going to show the dog because we didn't know what that meant. We thought show, like a confirmation show. She was a mutt. So I had loosed standards from the very beginning, no criteria whatsoever. By no one's fault. That was pet dog training. And so that was the moment that I recognize as setting the stage for our long, mediocre career.
So can you help me teach my dogs basic manners? Because I can teach go outs and scent articles, but my dogs are heathens in the house.
No, I forgot how to teach that when I got so my current dog is he's a black field lab. He's 4.5 years old. He just got his novice title in October. He's working on open. We've had a couple of successes and a bunch of failures. But he's well along the way to being able to qualify and open and go on to utility.
So have you lost your excitement for go outs and scent articles, or are you still excited about those?
I mean, the mystique, just the stunningness of that has left because I understand it, and I understand that it's not that big of a deal. It just takes a lot of training and a lot of work and a lot of pieces to train.
See, I don't know if I wrote a blog on it or I did a webinar. I can't even remember. It's all a blur. But you know, like when I train in front of the Walmart and I'm just doing things that to me, and I'm just, you know, hyper-focused on the details and I'm like, oh, my dog, I flick. And someone walks up and is like, I can't even get my dog to sit down. It reminds me, right? Like that I shouldn't forget that, like, yeah, scent articles are super cool. Like when pet people watch my dog with scent articles, they're like amazed. And go outs are pretty amazing. Like, and you just said it does take a really long time to teach it. And I think it's important because when we start training for competition, we get so down in the weeds sometimes that we forget to step back and remember, like, what, like, the wonder and the awe, and that's what initially drew us in, and that we should check in with that periodically, because otherwise we run the risk of just seeing what, you know, what's not going well. I mean, you're pretty good at not going down that road, but people in general at seeing what's not going well, what could be better, what they haven't accomplished yet. So anyway, it's just a reminder.
It's kind of a boost. When I was a couple of weeks ago in the Lowe's parking lot, and I was just doing some training. There was a couple there loading some, you know, topsoil bags into their truck, and they were kind of watching me, and Curly was doing like position changes. I was only like 10 feet away from him, because it was a very challenging environment for him. He was downing, he was sitting, he was standing, he'd down, he'd sit, he'd stand on my command. And I've released him because he'd worked through something difficult. He put him in the car and gave him some treats. And they drove past and they're like clapping at me. Because it is. I mean, you do have to realize just how, I don't know, whatever, just how amazing it is that we can do any of these things and how long of a road it is and how, whatever, how big of an accomplishment it is, even when things aren't going really well.
Right. So saying that, tell me what you love about training and what some of your biggest challenges are with training now or in recent years.
So what I love about training more than anything that I remember brilliantly clearly with training Rufus is the connection that you have with your dog. Now, I don't mean to say that you can't have a really wonderful relationship and connection with a pet dog. But when you're doing the sort of communication with a dog that you've got to do in obedience or agility or field work or any number of sports where you've developed this communication system with your dog, you have this understanding with each other. You can look at your dog, you can understand I'm not so good at this. I'm still trying to develop this, but I've got a rudimentary understanding of how to read Curly's mental states on the basis of what his body's doing, and the basis of what his ears doing, and the basis of what his mouth is doing. And he's telling me things, and we're communicating with each other, and we've got this relationship. And that training relationship, that deep relationship, carries into the rest of life, and it makes our pet dog relationship all that much more deep, significant, something like that. So that's one thing I really love. What was the second part of the question?
Well, let me just, I just want to make a quick comment on that. Like, it's the same thing for me when I can't train my dogs for a while, like if I have a dog that's injured or something, after a few days, it's the weirdest thing. I feel like I miss them and they're right there. They're like with me all the time. My dogs are with me like practically 24/7. Like, I'm on the couch, she's laying right there on the chair, and I'm like, I miss her. Because it's that when we are training, we're communicating on such a completely different level. And it's the same. Like, my first dog, TJ, I loved him to death. You know, he was just a pet dog. I don't even know if he could walk on a leash. I doubt it. Like, you know, we just hung out. But nothing has ever been the same since I started training dogs. Like, it's brought the relationship to a whole completely different level. And that's why I love it. And I'm addicted to it.
I have a similar experience. If by choice or by necessity, I take a couple of days off from training, and Curly's just around the house and he's following me around, and we're not doing our normal activity of training, I feel like I'm cheating him out of something that like, oh, poor dog, he doesn't get to, you know, engage in this interaction.
And I think they miss it too, because, you know, if my dogs don't train for X amount of days, they start to get whiny, they start to get pushy. Even Zeal, you know, he's just about 13. He's like, I want my turn, because they enjoy that one-on-one interaction. And it's not just me like playing with them per se. It's exactly what you said, which is communicating with them. And as we all know, as we struggle to communicate with one another, our family members, spouses, significant others, good communication is highly reinforcing. So the other thing is, what are your challenges with training?
How many episodes do you want to have in my challenges? I think one of my, let me pick one for the moment. I think that one of my biggest challenges is not knowing how fast to go, and either going too slowly or too quickly. So I just listened to episode 4 today, where you were talking about building duration on the hold. And people go from 1 second to 5 seconds, and it's a cluster because they're going too quickly. They're not going from 1 second to 1.5 to 2.5 over a period of a little bit of time anyhow. My default seems to be, I tend to go a little bit too slowly. And so I probably would be a little bit further along with Curly if I put things together a little bit sooner. Part of this is your fault, because you always stress the pieces, and work on the pieces. And I've taken that a little bit to an extreme, where I'm not doing full exercises enough, and I'm certainly not doing enough chunks of a class enough. So just that, and you talked about it in some good detail in episode 4 about how to, you know, be more mindful about pushing the dog just a little bit more and a little bit more, and you can always back up. And I need to keep that better in mind.
I think a lot of people struggle with that. And that's actually the best example, because I can't tell you how many people get stuck on hold, and it's because they're, as soon as the dog closes mouth, click, click, click. And then they do it like 30 times. And then the dog's like, clearly the end behavior is put my mouth on it for a split second and then open it. And then they're like, I can't get to the next spot. So like, my tendency is, but see, that's kind of my personality, right? Like, I like to live on the edge a little bit. So yes, I believe in very strong foundations, but I'm always pushing it just a little bit going, can we go a little further? And if it comes undone, I'm like, okay, whoops, let me go back, strengthen that a little bit, push forward again. But I also think that people don't push forward because they're afraid, mm-hmm. right? Because if things go wrong, then all is lost. It's the end of the world. The dog is ruined. There's no turning back, right? And I think I've gone over the edge so many times and crawled my way back that I know that, yes, there is a way back as long as you don't, you know, go so far over the edge that the dog's like implodes. But if you're pushing it a little bit, I think part of it too is as humans, we're micromanagers. We need to give the dogs a little more credit. I see that with my students a lot. They're like giving them a cookie or a reinforcer like constantly. And I'm like, it's okay. Your dog can do it. Or they're teaching their dog something and they're really helping them. They're like leaning forward, using their hand, using their voice. I'm like, all right, hold on. Your dog's really smart. Don't do so much. Ask the dog to do it. The other part is when dogs struggle a little bit, people tend to panic, right? I think it's important for the dog to, you know, struggle a little bit as they're trying to figure out the information. Like when I learn something new, like, huh, you should see me trying to learn how to climb. Talk about struggling, right? Like you try and then you fall. Luckily the rope catches you, but then you get back up, you try it again, you fall. Like if I'm only ever going so cautiously that I'm never going to fall, it's going to take me forever to make any progress, right? That's why we're hooked up, because they expect you to fall, right? And I think it's the same with the dogs. Like we have to expect and say, oh, they're going to mess it up. Not the end of the world. I'm just going to help them out if they get really stuck. But, you know, I want my dogs to be problem solvers. I want them to go, not that. Okay, how about that? Not that. Well, how about that? So sometimes we have to step back. We have to push them a little bit. And more often than not, my students are pleasantly surprised. And they're like, oh, he figured it out. I'm like, see, I knew he could do it. So I think it's a combination of micromanaging, being afraid they're going to fail, or being afraid you're going to mess your dog up so bad that there's no returning from
that. Yeah, I think that some of it is the previous dog syndrome where I see the mistakes mm-hmm. that I made with Rufus and I overcorrected. Rufus got her novice and open titles, and then I was training her in utility and I put her in utility and she qualified the very first, like by a miracle, she qualified the first time that she was in utility. She had never even done a full clean run through qualifying in every exercise. It was just a miracle that she qualified. And then she failed to qualify. I don't know, 17 times, 23 times after that until she had to retire. So clearly I went too quickly, too far with her, at least in terms of getting her into the utility ring. And hello, I didn't go back. And I mean, I see now like all the things that she habitually did wrong are the things that a lot of utility dogs competing in utility habitually do wrong. And I have a much better understanding of now how I could have remediated those things. But anyhow, I just mean to say that some of my reluctance sometimes I think to push forward is based on my last dog syndrome and going too far too fast.
Yeah, last dog syndrome is very, very real. I have a lot of students that struggle with that and it's a challenge. Like, but usually it's pretty interesting because typically if I point it out or suggest that maybe that could be playing, you know, into it, I would say every single time the student's been receptive and thought about it and said, you know, or sometimes I'll just say, they'll say, oh, my dog's so nervous. And I'll say, I don't know. I'm reading that your dog is nervous at all. And then they're like, huh, And then all of a sudden they'll come back and they'll go, you know what? I think you're right. My last dog was really nervous, or my last dog was really this way or that way, or I did this with my last dog. You know, so it's always, I always say to them, like, train the dog in front of you, like that dog in front of you right now and the dog that you see on that day. And I fell victim to it, like, well, not, a pre- I didn't fall victim to previous, I fell victim to labeling my dog, but not previous dog syndrome. I was in a situation where Tyler was like my second dog, and he was a once in a lifetime. The longer I trained, the more I realized what a unicorn he was, like, and how lucky I was to have had him. I was very conscious that as his career was coming to a close and as I got my next dog, that it was going to be a huge challenge for me personally to not compare. Right? Like it would be so easy for me to compare all dogs after him to that dog, and they would all fall short. Mm-hmm. And then I'd be in a world of trouble, you know? But so I had to consciously always be like, this is a different dog. This is how this dog is. And that's perfectly fine. And not compare. And I've had to train all my dogs differently because they're all very different. So each dog I get, I know nothing and I start over from scratch. Mm-hmm. Yay. Mm-hmm. So what other struggles, like how do you feel about reading a dog? I think that's hard for students. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, I'm getting better at it. I can see, I'm sure I couldn't have seen this with Rufus. I could see that Rufus in the ring shut down, but I couldn't have looked at her face or her ears or her mouth or her tail and seen that outside of the ring. I just knew that she wouldn't move with me and she wouldn't set up. With Curly, I'm better at it, and I'm better at picking up subtle differences. So I know when we set up for an exercise and I give him the pre-cue and he bounces, and I can tell when he's fully engaged, when he's looking right at me and his mouth is open and his ears are perked up. And I can see if he's just not quite there and maybe he needs another up cue or an engagement cue.
What helped you get to that point? Like, how did you get from Rufus, because this is only your second dog, right?
Correct.
Who you couldn't read, you know, and rightly so, it was your first dog, to Curly, who you can not only read, but you can read these subtle differences. Like, how do you think you learned that? Other than me yelling at you, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, you yelling helps. I'm sure that you've covered this in courses and webinars and so on. But I think just experience in the sense of, if I go to take a first step of healing and he didn't have that expression, I get a negative reinforcement. I get a punishment because he lags or he's not fully engaged. He doesn't step off with enthusiasm. It's like, oh. So when he looks like that, something bad happened. So I don't want that. But then I learned, oh, this look on his face is associated with this behavior. Same thing like when I was doing signals in the parking lot of the Lowe's with a couple loading things in their pickup truck. I could see in his face. I mean, I did the exercise anyhow because I wanted him to push through and get rewarded for it. But I could see his ears, they were not perked up. They weren't flat against his face. His tail wasn't between his legs. He wasn't hunched over. He wasn't yawning. He wasn't showing signs of stress, super signs of stress. But like, he wasn't thrilled. He was in a difficult situation. Yeah, I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's just experience in seeing how the dog is reacting. When he looked like that, he didn't do
it. I think that's a key. I think people are focused on, they're like task oriented, right? So they're trying to get the task done. So like, if I'm going to heal, they set their dog up and then they say heal. And then the dog lags and then they're like, why did the dog lag? Versus you're doing it the opposite way. You're not being task oriented. You're first looking at the dog, then you're doing the task, and then you're pairing what you saw in the dog with what happened afterwards, right? And then you can start to put that information together.
Well, you give me a little bit too much credit because I do, I do sometimes find myself, I do take the first step of healing and he lags or, you know, whatever the exercise is. And I'm like, dang it, I should have seen that. I shouldn't have gone on. Like I saw it, but I wanted to ignore it. I just, because that's what people do. They're like, I want to get to the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say, you can't get to the exercise until the dog's ready for the exercise. I mean, you don't say exactly that, but that's the idea.
Yeah. So I'm always emphasizing, like, look at the dog first, read the dog, then decide what to do, right? Like, if I'm going to face my dog, if my dog's at a distance from me and I turn around and I look at my dog, I will never give my dog a cue unless I am pretty darn sure my dog's going to do it correctly. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I turn around and I look at my dog and my dog's distracted or confused or worried or looks like, you know, he's a little overwhelmed or not fully engaged. Well, I'm going to address that first. I am not going to now say to my dog, come or down or sit, right? And that's where people struggle. Same, I assess my dog every single time I put my dog in heel position. No matter if I've been training for 20 minutes, and I just gave my dog a reward and I put my dog back into heel position. In that moment, I assess my dog. Are you good? Are you focused? Are you a little too aroused? Are you a little too calm? Where are you? You good? You good? Okay, then we can keep going. You're not good? Then I'm going to do something to adjust your state of mind or your emotional state so that you're in a good place to continue on. So, yeah, I think that's a really good point, right? Like, you must read the dog first, then adjust whatever you need to, then cue the dog.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, it's hard in the sense that, you know, you're in a run through and the judge is there and you don't want to take too much time in the ring, or you're just training with a group of people and you don't want to take too much time in the ring, but you just have to do it. And I've gotten better at doing that. Well, I'm not going to do the whole run. I'm not going to do all the exercises. Right. I'm going to do this until he gets it right. Why just plow through? That's a memory I have with a lot of training sessions with Rufus. We'd go in the garage, we'd train for 20 minutes, and I'd ask myself, what did I just accomplish? Because all I did is I went through the motions. And so,
well, that's all you knew how to do.
In a way it was, just to go through the motions and do the full exercise or the whatever. But in any event, that's related to just the whatever, the mental fortitude that it takes me to, this is what I'm doing right now. Other people can wait. I won't take too much time. I'll cut, you know, I won't do other things that I was planning to do so that my dog is fully engaged in the first step of healing. That's what it means.
Yeah, people really struggle with that. Like, social pressure is real.
Yeah.
Unless you're me and you're not social. Then you're just like, yeah, I don't care. No. It's real. I have that constantly with students, right? They feel pressured from other people, whether it's in class, whether the people are actually saying something or not. And sometimes mm-hmm. people do say things, right? Because people are people. And sometimes they don't, same thing. They feel pressure from a judge. They feel pressure in a match or a show and go. They feel pressure when they're out in front of a store. Like, so the only thing I can suggest to people and that I suggest to them all the time is you are a team. Like, when that's what you're called, right? When you go in the ring or when they do awards, the judge says team number. He doesn't say my name, or he says team. So your dog is your teammate. So your first priority is to your teammate. That's, you know, the person, well, that's the animal that I put my teammate first, period, end of the story, right? So, and I'm the one that decided to do this crazy thing. The dog did not choose it. You know, I'm not saying my dog wouldn't choose to work with me, but, you know, we ask our dogs to do some crazy things with some crazy rules. We should put them first. And I think if people can just kind of change their mindset about that, and really at the end of the day, most people don't mind. And even if they do, it's just a temporary thing. And like you said, you're not going to take more time than anybody else, right? Like when I go to matches or show and goes or training sessions, I'm never taking any more time than anybody else. If anything, I'm taking less time. But in that time, I am always prioritizing my dog first. And even when I'm in the ring, like I am going to put my dog first. And if that means I need to be excused or if that means I need to ignore the judge, so be it, because I have to put my dog first, right? It's they're trying so hard to do what we want, the poor things.
So it's true. It's social pressure, and that's what the reality is. And for listeners of this podcast in particular, they're probably people who know you, know Lori, know your training methods, have taken courses with you, have seen you, like the way that you train, and they probably already recognize that you teach some things in an unconventional way. And then when I go out into other contexts and people see me doing unconventional, well, sometimes people just yell at me for doing unconventional things. They say, what are you doing? You're going to ruin your dog. So on a previous episode, you were talking about releasing the dog from pressure. In the novice class, there's a stand for exam exercise. The judge says, stand your dog and leave when ready. You walk 6 feet away after you stand the dog. The judge comes up, touches the dog, and the head withers and buttocks and backs away and says, back to your dog. Well, the way you teach it is, as the judge approaches, as you're training, that's a high pressure situation for the dog. The dog doesn't want to be there. So give the dog a positive association with that situation, perhaps even by backing into the pressure. But once the dog is in that situation, the reward for bearing it is being released from the pressure. And I remember one time I did it early on with Rufus and Curly in a run through. Boy, the person playing judge just laid into me, said, what are you doing? Your dog's going to break in a trial. And I tried to explain what was going on. It fell on deaf ears. I was further berated. Curly showed in novice and did that stand for exam exercise, I want to say 10 times. Let me count the number of times he released himself. Zero.
Zero.
So, but anyhow, the general point is that there's a lot of pressure if you're bucking conventional wisdom and you're doing things like Petra does and like Lori does. You just have to kind of get a thick skin and say, thank you for that information. This is the way I'm going to do it for now, or something.
I think it's unfortunate. I don't think you can really do, there aren't many things you can do that involve competition where there aren't also going to be some negative encounters, right? So like I've competed in many different things like horseback riding, cycling, and there's always going to be some negativity. It's just human nature, I think. I don't think there's any escaping it. I mean, there's really no escaping it in everyday life. Some people are pleasant, some are not. Some people feel like they have to tell you you're doing something wrong. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many people have been telling me my entire life that I'm going to blow out my knees and be arthritic from running. And yeah. I'm almost 58 and I'm still running and my knees and hips are still in good shape. Yeah. Who knew?
There right? is negativity, but I also think that some people, especially when they see me and they especially remember how mediocre I was with Rufus, they're actually trying to be helpful. Oh, this guy's making more mistakes.
That's true.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah, and I agree. Sometimes they're trying to be helpful and it may not come across that way. I think for me, and like I've had a lot of challenges. I've had times where people, you know, I've had instructors tell me, if you're going to do it that way, it's not going to work. And when it falls apart, I'm not going to help you fix it and put it back together. Mm-hmm. Right? I've been told that. And so I went home and I thought about it and I said, well, you know what? I'm willing to take the risk. So again, maybe I have a little bit of this risk taker personality, but I also, it's not really that. I'm constantly trying to improve, right? Like to this day, I want to be a better trainer and I want to be a better instructor and I want to be a better communicator. So I'm always trying new things. I'm always trying different things because I want to get better, right? If I just followed the status quo, I'd still be doing everything the way I did with Tyler, and for sure, Zeal would have been washed out. For sure, Zaina would have been washed out, right? Because those dogs couldn't train like that. Like it wouldn't have worked. So I think we have to just say that, you know, we have to be willing to train in a way that makes us comfortable. We want to try something different. We're willing to take this chance and see if it works out. And just know that, okay, some of that might come with it, but you know, it's not easy. I get it. Because, you know, everybody's going to have their own little bit of insecurity. I have it too. Like when my dogs are struggling, I'm like, oh God, am I ever going to figure this out? People are going to be like, she's an instructor. She can't even get her own dog to do this. Right? Like we all have those voices in our head. And then when people say things like that, it makes that voice louder. So it's a challenge, but I think it's worth pushing through it in the end. I think we just have to try to hang out with like-minded people if possible.
True.
Maybe that's the error. So I'm going to ask you a question. I commonly hear from students, you've told me this 1,000 times. What? Why am I still doing it wrong? What do you think that is?
Oh, I think it's, I don't know. So it happened yesterday. When we were working on Curly's dumbbell retrieve. And the goal was to get him to bring the dumbbell all the way back. He dropped the dumbbell on the way in. We went and I redid it. And I gave him help on the second rep, and I wasn't supposed to reward him and feed him. It was a good, not a yes. And what did I do? I fed him. Now, to my credit, I recognized the second I did it, right before you said, why did you feed him? And I said, I have no explanation. I have no excuse. But here's my explanation for why those things happen. Because as a pretty green trainer, there are so many things to keep track of in training that happen in rapid succession. So here I am thinking, I set him up for the dumbbell throw. I get his mental state up. His ears are perked up. He seems willing to go out with enthusiasm. I've got to think about how I'm going to throw the dumbbell and where I'm going to throw it, with what arc and based on this surface in this building. So it doesn't go whatever. So it lands at the appropriate spot. I got to remember it's the flat. So I'm going to say fetch. It's not the high. I'm not going to say hop. So I say fetch. He goes and get it. I'm looking at him very carefully to see if he's going to do a clean pickup so I can intervene and explain to him that's the wrong thing to do if he bobbles it. And he comes back. So I'm keeping track. I'm trying to keep up with everything that's happening in the moment, and my brain doesn't work that fast. And so the dog drops the dumbbell and I wait until he's at my side to say anything because my brain just didn't catch up because there's so many my brain is full. There's there's a Far Side cartoon. Remember that from the 80s? There's this one Far Side cartoon. There's a student in class and he says, Mr. Osborne, may I be excused? My brain is full. And that's what I feel like sometimes when I'm training, my brain is full and I can't make my body do anything else. I can't make the words come out of my mouth fast enough because I can't perceive and react quickly enough. I mean, a lot of things I'm better at, that's coming, but it's so many things happening at once or in rapid succession that I'm trying to keep track of. every moment so I can catch a mistake, so I can give appropriate feedback, so I can adjust a cue, so I can give the next cue.
And I'm wondering how we could have made that easier for you, right? Because we were really good at breaking it down for the dog. So like maybe for the student, like what if that's something for me to ponder, right? Like what if instead of doing a formal retrieve, I just had you like hold his collar and just throw the dumbbell and send him. Would that have taken some steps out? Maybe. And would that have freed up some brain space? Or is it just literally a matter of time training, like months and years? And
simplifying for any learner like the dog, you know, breaking it down into pieces, that might help. In that, I don't know, it's just the best I can explain it is I just flaked.
Yeah, well, it is because there is so much to think about, right? It's everything you're thinking about, everything you have to do, right, as a trainer. And we have to think about everything the dog is doing, and everything happens relatively quickly and it's fluid, right? Like it's not like the same thing happens every time at the same point, right? Like at one point, he dropped the dumbbell when he was right in front of you. At another point, he dropped the dumbbell halfway, you know, half distance away from you.
Right.
So it's not like I can say, well, it's never predictable. And it's never, dog's not the same day to day. And the dog's not the same moment to moment, right? Like I've competed with my dogs where I come out of the ring and I'm exhausted because, especially with an inexperienced dog, because like I have to, 1 minute my dog's like really high, and then the next minute my dog's worried, and then the next minute my dog's like this, and I'm constantly adjusting, and I come out and I'm like, holy cow, like that was really hard. Mm-hmm. So, and the whole time we have to use a lot of mental concentration, right? We have to be completely focused on the task at hand, because otherwise things are just going to slip by. I think one of the things I've been trying to instill in some of my students is, because I spent a lot of time thinking like, well, okay, why can I react quickly, right? Other than the fact that I've been doing it a while, like, but why is my reaction time pretty good? And why can I like read my dog, react, adjust, and immediately adjust on the fly? And I think part of it is because I have taken a lot of concepts, like fundamental ideas, and memorized them to the point that I no longer need to think about them consciously, right? So it's kind of like driving the car, right? Like if my dog makes two errors, no lie, this weird thing happens in my head where it's almost like I, like in my brain, like it visualizes like alarm bells are going off. And so that makes me stop at two errors and not keep going, right? So even if I feel this weird urge to keep going, because I still feel it, I don't know what that is about as human, but my brain's like, no, because I memorized two and I told myself two over and over and over, and I did more than two and chastise myself because no, you're only supposed to do two. So now two is automatic. Like I never, you know, the dog never makes more than two errors because my brain just does that. So now that I no longer have to think about. Same with how I handle an error. I have a formula. I know how I'm going to handle it. I have memorized it. Like inside out, backwards, forward. So it requires zero conscious thought. Like I tell people in the ring, when my dog makes a mistake in the ring, I have already fixed the error. Mm-hmm. And then my brain goes, oh shit, we flunked.
Oh, I just failed. Yeah. So I wonder, do you think one thing that helps you or has helped you to develop the ability to see things quickly in the moment is by helping so many other students and perceiving from that outside perspective, not inside doing the training, but from the outside observing someone else's training, what they should do in that moment. Do you think that that has helped you?
I think it's made it better, but I feel like even when I first started, I could look at a video and I could see like minute details instantly. It's like a weird thing. Like mm-hmm. my brain just instantly can see everything the handler's doing, everything the dog's doing, what should have been done in that moment. Like, and my brain can process that super, super quickly. I don't know why. Like, I have a couple theories. One of them is that I just have the kind of personality, like, I do things that I love. And when I love something, I'm passionate about it and I'm obsessed by it. So I read a million books. I listen to a million podcasts. I watch thousands of videos. Like, I think about it all the time because I enjoy it. It's a puzzle. I want to figure the puzzle out. I also think that, so I read this super interesting article once. It said that people that have jobs that look for errors, like lawyers, mm-hmm. Tend to not be good in human relationships because that carries over into their life. And when I read that, I was like, oh, that's so interesting because I'm a physical therapist, right? So whenever, you know, like if you see somebody limp, it's kind of impolite to stare at them limping, right? I'm like, why is that person limping? until I diagnose what is wrong with them, then I can stop looking at that person. But like, it draws my eye and my brain immediately goes into diagnostics. Like, and then I think with working with dogs, that develop that even more because dogs can give you zero feedback, right? It's all hands. Mm-hmm. So tactile feeling and observation. And you have to observe super subtle things visually and with your hands. And you have to trust that. And you have to see it relatively quickly because you don't have, you know, all day to watch this dog trot back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I think that those skills that my eye gets drawn to those things, like when I watch any animal, poor deer's running across the street. I'm like, oh God, it's limping. What's wrong with it? You know, like that's what my brain does. It mm-hmm. just goes there. So maybe that part of my brain is just very strong. I've always had, which I don't necessarily think is optimal, but it's unfortunately the way my brain is wired, where it's very hard for me to focus on one thing for an extended period of time. So my brain's always been scattered. And so I'm always doing like three things at once. So does that have a part to play in it? Maybe yes, maybe no. I have no idea. But I do think there's benefit for people to not just observe their own dog when they're training.
Right.
Right. Like, so I also have always subconsciously, I didn't even realize it for a very long time, observed every one of my dogs. So if I closed my eyes right now, I could tell you exactly how each of my individual dogs moves. Right. From whether it's whether the way they sleep, the way they stand up, sit down, trot, go in and out the dog door, run, jump, the way they look when I'm hiking them, like that's ingrained in my brain. So like I've had clients where I'll look at the dog and go, does your dog always sit like that? And they go, I don't know. And I'm like, how can you not know? It's your dog. Right. So observing your dogs, observing other dogs. I think watching other people train, whether it's good or bad, it's still going to give you information. You're going to learn watching other dogs in the ring. I think taking classes from other instructors. Videotape is huge. Like, I can't overemphasize that. So when I first started, teaching online, I was very skeptical. I was teaching, you know, in-person lessons, and I thought to myself, there is no way I'm going to be able to give these people the same quality of information, the same quality of instruction, like via video and typing, like versus being in person. There's no way. Mm-hmm. But I was like, well, I don't know. I'll try it. And other people are doing it. I'll just, maybe it's some people are good with that sort of instruction. And over time, I realized, I said, wow, these, my online students are learning much more quickly than my in-person students. So I thought about why, and I realized it's because they're videotaping themselves, then they're editing it. And when they look at the video, after a while, they'll submit the video and say, you're going to tell me that at 30 seconds, I should have done this instead. That is gold. Because now you're analyzing your own mistakes and you're figuring it out on your own. That's where you're really going to advance in your learning. You're going to advance as a trainer. So that, I think, is super helpful.
Right. I video as much as I can, and I watch as much of it as I can. And it's hard to watch sometimes because, like, oh man, I'm doing this thing, but it's really instructive.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's really valuable. And we've talked about it on the podcast before, Lori and I, like, Lori's really good. She even records all her own sessions, right? But, yeah, it is. It is so challenging dog training because there's so much going on at the same time. So I just encourage students to, you know, really try and get those fundamentals memorized so that they're second nature. And then it's probably just time, you know, it's probably just time. And I also do think it's valuable. Have you taken courses from other instructors or just like,
some,
you know, podcasts, webinars, workshops, classes, anything like that?
Some.
Did you think that was helpful, getting a different perspective?
Yeah, it is. It's you always get something, yeah. No matter what, you always get something that you can take away. So it is helpful, and I should probably do that more.
Yeah, I think that is important for people. Like, I still do that. Like, I still listen to podcasts from, and it doesn't even matter if it's from a different sport, right? Like Canine Sensibilities has a podcast and it's about detection work, right? I don't care. Dog training is dog training, right? I've listened to a number of their episodes that I thought were helpful. Sometimes it's, and even if it's just like a reminder or hearing someone say something in a different way, I think that's valuable. I think that's really valuable. I think everybody should do that. You know, right. Podcasts, videos, classes, watching people at trials, right? I think that's valuable. And watching the dogs and how they react mm-hmm. in competition. I think we were talking about that a little bit yesterday, you and mm-hmm. I. Yeah, I think that's important. What about, do you write notes and review them or no? Just curious.
When you give me feedback, I write notes and I review those. And I try to have a training log, like the things that I'm currently working on or things that I want to do. I'm not as good about that as I should be, but I've always got a plan for what I'm going to do in a particular training session. So I train with my friends on Wednesday morning, and I've got whatever, the things that are my top priorities to work on, and those are written down. And I try to go through those things. And if I don't get to all of them, I don't get to all of them. If I train after dinner, before dinner in my backyard, I've always got a plan for what I'm going to do.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everybody doesn't.
I mean,
that's probably because you're a doctor. You're a PhD. You're very smart.
I'm not sure about the very smart part. You know, when we were, it doesn't matter. Yeah, I'm not sure about the very smart part.
Well, no, it is very smart because I mean, I've done it myself countless times where I finish my training session, I write my notes down, and a lot of students do this, right? At some point they write notes because I'm like, you have to write notes, you have to have a plan. And then what do we all do? We forget to read them before we train.
Oh, geez.
And then I start my training plan and I get halfway through and I'm like, oh my God, I was supposed to do this strategy for this exercise, not the one I was just doing. Like I had just figured out in the prior training session that the best option is X, and here I am doing Y. Like, what is wrong with me? So now, like, I have a strategy where I write the note and then the note immediately goes into my training bag. So it's
Nice.
right there at the top of the training bag. Like, hello. So that I don't forget to actually read it before. And I think the main thing is like, yeah, I've been doing this for eons and I still write notes for both my dogs, and review them. So
Yeah,
I think that's really important.
and I do that as well at a trial. If there are certain things that I know I
Good
need to
point.
do, I'll write the notes. They're typewritten notes that I'll type, the day before the trial, and then I print them out. I take them and I read them at my crate just to remind myself of whatever it is. In the warm-up, I've got to be sure that he doesn't bash me on the finish, and so I need to step into him to be sure that to remind him, things like that. Because otherwise, I'll forget. I'll go through the motions of some warm-up or another, and then I won't get out of it what I, he won't get out of it what he needs to get out of it before we go in.
Do you remember? I think it was the first NOC, so that's our national. You were helping me. I think it was the first one. I mean, I do it at everyone. And I had all these notes written out, like
Yes, yes.
piles of notes
Yes.
on my crate, and you looked at and you're like, you really write like
You
all
had
those?
full sentences and four single space pages of notes. I'm like, wow, she needs to do that. That says something.
Yes, like I still need to do that because there's so much to remember, especially in competition, right? There's just so much to remember. There are things for myself mentally I need to remember. There's things I need to remember for my handling. There are things I need to remember to do for my dog for their warm up. And then because everything is fluid, like if I go in the ring and I come out and I check the video and I see like, ooh, he looked a little worried there. Or, ooh, I can see that if I don't go remind him of this behavior or reinforce this behavior a few times, it's going to potentially fall apart.
Yeah.
So then I need to adjust that, right? So then I have notes for if his drop is slow, do this. Because the other thing that happens is when we're at a competition, we're under stress. And when we're under stress, we don't always make poor decisions. Sometimes we do what people around us are doing. Sometimes we do things because we're panicking. And then we end up doing things we don't normally do, or we inadvertently put pressure on the dog. So by having it written out, there is no ambiguity. I can't, suddenly decide I'm going to do some wacky thing to fix my drop on recall. My dog's going to be like, what in the world are you doing? Right? It's going to say, this is, do a few up close, do them as a fun game, throw them a cookie or whatever. So yes, I
Right.
did have lots of notes and I started already writing my notes for this one, which will be twice as fun. Because I
Yeah.
have two dogs, I'm sure.
Here's a quick note about notes. So I'm a retired college professor, and in a previous episode, Lori was talking about when she was a college student, she would always take notes in class, and then she would recopy her notes afterwards. And I think that you said you did the same thing, and my heart was still, because that's what I told my students. Take your notes, but your notes are notes. You need to recopy. Now, there's a dog training point in here. You need to recopy them to get that cemented in your mind fully. But see, here's the thing. Just the very act of writing it down, that's going to cement it in your mind and make you more likely to remember it and do it in the future. So there's two things. One, writing it down, that gets it in your brain, and then you've got it written down at the trial and you read it, and that gets it further cemented in the moment.
Yeah, that's really important. This is why I still handwrite a lot of my notes, which is kind of old fashioned, but it does help me. It's like a review. It's a review for me. It helps cement it in my brain.
Right.
So in dog training, there's an enormous amount of frustration, failure. It takes forever to get our dogs ready to trial. Like, there's so much time and work and effort put in. Like, what do you do? How do you handle it when you get frustrated or things don't work out the way you planned, or you go in the ring and it didn't go as well as you had hoped, or training's going south, or any number of those things?
I'll try to be brief. So, you know, I was diagnosed with cancer about 5 years ago, and my mind went, I wonder if it's going to hurt to die of cancer. I wonder if the treatment will be painful. I wonder who's going to take care of things. I better get my affairs in order. And I thought, I better stop thinking like this. And I started to do research and look into what people do who were going through something really difficult. And I stumbled on this YouTube video of this woman who was a resilience. She was an academic psychologist who studied the trait of resilience, what gives people the ability to bounce back. She herself had just had a bunch of tragedies. Two children died. Her husband died. She was diagnosed with cancer. The trait that resilient people have is the ability to look around and say, everyone goes through things like this. I've got cancer. I did then. I don't now. I've got cancer. It's a common affliction. I'm going to be able to get through it because I recognize that other people are struggling also. Well, go to a dog trial. This weekend I showed in one class in 2 days, 12 people in the class. Once one person in that class qualified, and other classes before me, there were very, very few qualifiers. And I look and I'm like, okay, I'm in the same boat as a lot of people. In many ways, I'm in an okay situation, comparatively speaking. That's one thing that helps, is just recognizing that other people are going through the same thing. There's nothing special about it. When something bad happens, I try not to catastrophize it. So there's this Buddhist, I don't know if they call them parables, but it's a Buddhist story of the two arrows, I think it's called. You're shot by an arrow, and it's painful. It hurts. And that symbolizes the suffering that's part of everybody's life. Life is full of suffering, as a basic Buddhist recognition. And then when you're shot by the arrow, you say, oh man, that ruined my favorite shirt. It's getting blood in my pants. It's going to get blood in the car. The dog is licking the blood off the floor. I'm going to go to the emergency room. The people with heart attacks and strokes are going to be ahead of me, and I'm going to die of blood. Well, you just shot yourself with about 12 more arrows. You dwell on the suffering you're right. Okay. So you get it. So don't catastrophize, just in the moment. Yep. That's suffering. That's painful. Now solve the problem. Just get to the emergency room. Don't shoot yourself with more arrows.
Right.
But then also the thing that helps me a lot is noticing how far I've come in comparison to, I mean, a year ago, but especially, you know, 4 years ago when Rufus was the dog who was literally 3 feet behind me on the healing pattern and who I gave the signals and stared at me like a deer in headlights. And I look at a video of Rufus healing and I look at a video of Curly healing. I'm like, wow, I have really come a long way. So whatever sport that you're in, you make progress over a several week period, certainly over a 6 month period. And if you step back and look at that progress, for me, that helps a lot to say, I might suck, but not nearly as much as I did 6 months ago, let alone 4 years. Anyhow, those are some quick thoughts, because I know that you don't want to go too long.
No, those are perfect thoughts. Perfect. I think we have to end on that because I couldn't have said that any better.
Okay.
That was awesome. Thank you so much for accepting my volunteering to be our first guest here on the podcast. We really appreciate it. You shared a lot of awesome information. I think when people struggle with dog training, a lot of times they feel like they are unique and they are the only one having these struggles and that they're terrible and they're horrible and they're failing their dog. And you're just like all of us. You're just a dog trainer.
That's right. We're all doing the best we can. We're all suffering, but trying not to shoot too many more arrows at ourselves.
We're all suffering together. Yes.
Well, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Lori will definitely be back with us next time. All right. Happy training, everybody. Bye-bye.